Hello, radio family. Welcome to Divine Intervention, the interview show that features intriguing people who've experienced the hand of God in amazing ways. I'm your host, Daniel Fazina, and today I have the privilege of introducing you to a woman who is very well known in political circles, and she also happens to be an amazing follower of Jesus with a pretty cool story. My special guest today is Star Parker. Star Parker is the founder and president of CURE, the Center for Urban Renewal and Education, which is a nonprofit think tank which promotes market-based public policy to fight poverty. Before involvement in social activism, Star Parker had 7 years of firsthand experience in the grip of welfare dependency. Star Parker's personal transformation from welfare dependent to cultural crusader has been chronicled on ABC's 2020, Rush Limbaugh, Reader's Digest, James Dobson, The 700 Club, Dr. George Grant, Christianity Today, James Robison, Newsmax, Charisma, and World Magazine. Her websites are starparker.com and urbancure.org, and it is my pleasure to welcome Star Parker right now on Divine Intervention to share about her life, her political activism, and her faith. Star, you are on Divine Intervention. Welcome to the show, and thanks for being here.
You're so welcome. This is a wonderful invite. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you and all the work you do, and I was very excited to meet you at the Values Voter Summit. We had a nice time hanging out, and we want to get to all the wonderful work you're doing. But before we do that, let's go to the beginning a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and who you are and how you grew up?
Well, I grew up in a military household. My dad was a part of the first integrated force in the Air Force, and immediately was pulled into the chaos of Vietnam. So he shipped over to the Philippines, and we were shipped over to Japan after having been shipped a whole lot of different places. When we came back, it was right after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed, and the country was on fire, and I was very young and impressionable and got very excited about the fires and the potential of joining in with some of the mayhem. And began this journey at that point in what we would consider ill activities. And over time, they escalated to the point that I was very reckless with the decisions I was making, getting involved in all types of criminal and drug activity, and then sexual promiscuity that led me in and out of abortion clinic after clinic, and then finally on the welfare, in and out for 7 years, 3.5 years consistently, and then God found me in that little black hole that I dug out for myself after stealing my brother's car and driving it to California, thinking I could run away from myself, and finding out that I was bankrupt morally and finding myself in an existence that wasn't real pleasing, but yet was okay.
Okay.
And so I just bought into this living every day. I bought into the lie that poor people are poor because rich people are rich, and I bought into the ideas that I didn't have to do anything to mainstream my life, and I just lived recklessly and lawlessly, and God saw me down there doing that and finally said, that's enough. So I was looking to subsidize my welfare check one day and went into a business asking them to pay me under the table. It was a small business in South Central Los Angeles, and normally people that are running these businesses, because of the cruelty of government to regulate them and keep them from being able to grow, they'll pay you under the table just so that they can get the help that they need. They'll get a little cash and keep it off their books. But these folks said that, nope, they weren't going to do that. They were legitimate businessmen. And, of course, I challenged that because at that point I'd bought the lie of the left that African Americans should not mainstream. So I challenged them that they are mainstreaming their lives in a racist society, and they challenged me back. That my lifestyle was out of control and it was unacceptable. And when I asked them unacceptable to who, they said to God. And I hadn't heard God before. I certainly hadn't thought about God with a capital G, and it made me quite nervous, and I got out of there, and they had my phone number, so they started calling me. And they called me so often that I finally went to their church just so that they would stop calling me.
They were inviting you to the church?
Oh, yeah.
That's why they were calling?
Oh, yeah.
Now, Star, were you raised in a Christian home and just went astray, or?
No, I didn't. If I were raised in a Christian home, then when I heard the word God, I would have knew what it meant.
What was your perception of God, or?
I didn't have any. I just knew that when the way they said your lifestyle is unacceptable to God, it just there was an inquisitiveness about that. I didn't know what it meant, but I knew that there was something there.
Okay.
It made me nervous, as I said.
Tell us a little bit more about that time period in your life, you know, in the late 60s when things were going on and, you know, the culture was in a lot of conflict. You had Vietnam, the assassinations of President Kennedy, and then, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. You have the drug culture and the race riots. What was that time like? I mean, you said you were young and impressionable and led into a lifestyle that was unacceptable.
Yeah, so when you see the city burning and you see fire, and yeah, fire is exciting, and you're meeting people that are saying, let's go make mayhem, sure, why not?
And this is in Los Angeles?
No, this was in East St. Louis, Illinois. That was
Oh, okay.
Where we were stationed when we first came back from Japan.
Oh, okay. And you were saying that God found you in this lifestyle. How exactly do you mean?
Well, by then I was in California, and
okay.
So, I mean, I'm living just day to day,
mm-hmm.
And when I was introduced to the concept of Christ, when I finally went to the church with these young men, and I heard the gospel, it resonated in my heart, And so when the preacher said, do you want to be saved, I said, yes, why not? Why would I object to that? It was a message of hope and encouragement. It was a message of reconciliation, of meaning, so I didn't have any reason to say no.
That's great. I wish a lot of people would think that way. You know, a lot of people have a lot of intellectual and other type of objections, but really the
I think
gospel,
a lot of them have that because they may have heard about it before and just didn't want it.
They
were raised that way and heard things that they didn't want to hear. Or maybe they were raised that way and heard things that weren't even true about God. I mean, you have a lot of denominations that preach a God that you don't find in Scripture.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand.
Know, preach a harsh God, and yet I found to be a loving God. So, you know, it just depends. So I don't know why when I heard it, I wanted to believe it. Perhaps it was because it was being introduced to me personally. It wasn't, you know, somewhere far out. I mean, it's not like the word God wasn't in the Pledge of Allegiance or...
That's
things
true.
Like this, to where you hear of, you know, this personality that's not being defined for you. But once he's been defined for you, and then you recognize that you can have a personal relationship with him through his son, Jesus Christ, so, yep, it sounded good to me.
That's wonderful. If you don't mind, you mentioned before that you had gone into in and out of several abortion clinics. How did you find yourself in that situation, and what was that like going through that?
Oh, I found myself in that situation because I was pregnant and I was not married. And
was this presented to you as like your only option or your way out? Or I mean,
well, I didn't think about it that deeply. I was on drugs.
Oh, okay. You know, when you actually went in for the procedure, was there any counseling?
No counseling, no type of anything. That's why I work so readily with the crisis pregnancy centers in our country today, because they at least are building out alternatives so that people can get some information about the horrors of abortion and what it's doing to us as people and as a society and what ultimately it's doing to God. But no, at that point, we're talking about now the early 80s, there was no counsel. Abortion was new. Most people didn't care as long as it didn't touch them. They allowed, many of them even bought the idea of Margaret Sanger,
mm-hmm.
founded Planned Parenthood, that there are too many poor people, there are too many minority people, and so the best way to get rid of them is to convince them to kill their offspring.
Wow.
So some people bought that idea, so they just let it go. And, of course, Margaret Sanger targeted low-income and poor communities to set up her abortion clinics. So, of course, when you went in there, they didn't tell you. So you ought to think about what you're doing. No, they were looking more at that $400 that the California taxpayers were readily dishing out to let me go and kill my offspring.
Wow. That is really tragic, and I'm really sorry you went through that, and I'm sorry that this phenomenon is still happening in America. But
by the thousands now, every single day. I mean, Planned Parenthood is one of the largest corporations in our society. They're a billion-dollar corporation, and taxpayers readily contribute $330 million of that.
That is
for
tragic.
Them to continue to kill children.
Wow.
And it's deeply scarring people. You know,
yeah.
I came out blessed by the Lord to be able to still birth children. I've met women all over this country who, after one abortion, have never been able to birth a child. I was blessed by God that I was forgiven by him and then was able to move on for to help speak into that darkness to try to do something about this curse that's on our land through abortion, whereas others are scarred for life.
Right.
I meet many women. One of them gave me a picture of her daughter who died in an abortion clinic. And when they die in these clinics, now they die alone because society has pretended that it'll go away. They'll elect politicians like the president of the country who believes not only should we abort all the way through the ninth month, he believes that even after a child is born alive that it should be killed.
Oh, my gosh.
He tried to pass a bill in Illinois. It's called the Born Alive Act that protects these babies. But he passed one that said, no, you have to let them die if they're born alive. So, it's tragic what happened to me, but it's even more tragic that it is continuing in our society at such rapid rates, it's with such aggressive money, and the scars that it's leaving behind. Abortion is hurting tremendously our society. We have walking zombies, walking dead women they committed 20, 30 years ago is haunting them and keeping them up as they age and have to face a living God.
And did you face a similar type of emotional trauma when you went through this?
This is why I suppose I just can't get away from loving him, because he loves me so much. Because, no, I didn't have to. I suppose because that sin was wrapped in so many other sins that he just wiped them away. And I just, when I heard how forgiving he is and how just he is and how merciful and compassionate he is, I just believed it in one fell sweep, so I didn't have to go through emotional trauma. Who I find to deal with a lot more are those that may have known better and then they do it anyway, and then they can't seem to forgive themselves, and or people like a couple I just met recently that, they talk themselves into aborting their third person that was going to be born. They already had two, and they talked themselves into it, and then they couldn't look at each other anymore.
Wow.
They ended up in divorce. The woman ended up in prostitution, but God, in his mercy, then reconciled them again. So it hits people in different ways depending on their backgrounds, their comfort levels, their situations. But at the end of the day, as a society, we have to stop this.
Right.
It's horrible. That would be like asking, some slaves endured real cruelty, but others, just the fact that he wasn't free was enough to say that it was pretty equal in the trauma that he had in his life. So abortion's the same way. It impacts everyone exactly the same to one degree, that there is somebody that they were responsible to bring into existence that is no more. They're not here. They will never be here. That in itself is enough. In my life, whether I went through an emotional upheaval or not, that in itself is enough to say, I've got to make sure that we stop this. I've got to make sure that I'm doing everything I can so that we as a society realize that we are on a horrible course and that we will be judged accordingly.
Right. Well, once again, we are speaking with Star Parker. She is an author and an activist, the founder of CURE, which is the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. And I'm your host, Daniel Fazina. You're listening to Divine Intervention Radio. Star, along those lines, I just want to encourage people to know that, from my understanding now, there are a lot of crisis pregnancy centers that offer abortion alternatives. And I understand that they outnumber abortion clinics 3-1 now.
Okay. Oh, absolutely. And pretty soon, in some communities, there won't be any abortion clinics, because there are a lot of people on the ground that are saying, while Washington's trying to figure out what they're going to do about what we call legal, but God calls unlawful, Roe v. Wade, overturning such, making sure that abortion is unthinkable. We have a lot of decent people in quiet communities doing the most amazing work to protect their interests. So they go in and volunteer in the pro-life centers, the crisis pregnancy centers. They're readily available for someone that might say, I'm in trouble. They will counsel them. They will love them. They protect them. They help them, whether their help is, I want to keep it, or I want to adopt it out, whatever that woman needs, whatever that family needs. We have many, many centers. I think last numbers I saw were up to 5,000. Most communities now have somebody there that will help someone that's in crises. And then there are two national organizations, Heartbeat International and CareNet, that umbrella these centers. So they together have teamed up with an option line that if somebody wants to find a local center, they can call this 1-800 option line and find one right up the street from their home. So anyone that's pregnant or knows someone that's pregnant, they have that perhaps might consider that pregnancy a crisis, they have alternative now. They mm-hmm. have, we have structures in place that you do not have to walk through that alone. So yeah, it's just amazing what individuals can do when a country is off course, that just quiet people can do this. It's what Mother Teresa said, that, you know, you just touch one, you've changed the world.
Right.
And that's what our centers do. They touch one to change the world. I tell them all the time when I speak at their banquets, you guys are my Harriet Tubmans. But during slavery, we had various people doing various things. Some were trying to work legislatively to get rid of this. Some were on the inside. Some were on the outside. Some were the printers. Some were the activists. Some were every area. We had somebody doing something. But we also had Harriet Tubman and the others that were a part of the Underground Railroad pulling them out one by one, one by one.
Right.
So that's what our centers are doing, and they're doing amazing, amazing work for the Lord.
That's great. I mean, everybody can have an impact, and everybody has a role. It's just a matter of finding out what your role is and what you can do.
Oh, yeah, and God calls us to those roles and expects us to do them. People that have resources, their role is just to make sure that those centers have the resources that they need to keep their doors open, to make sure that they have the ultrasound machine there, because 85% of the girls that see their baby on that little ultrasound machine won't abort. Mm. They're the ones that make sure that, you know, everything is there in place financially. Then you have others that say, well, I don't have any money, but I have a little time on my hand. They're the ones that go in and answer the phones and, you know, help love up the people, or they go out and become our sidewalk counselors and stand in front of these abortion mills and say, don't go in there, please. We have an alternative for you, and they pass out literature. So we have somebody doing some of everything, and it's a good work, and there's always room for others that just say, I need to do something. What we find more often is the people that are post-abort, that have had abortion touch their lives in some way, that they become some of the largest contributors to try to stop this great sin in this country.
Right. That reminds me of my good friend Julie Woodley, who I had on my show a while ago. She's an amazing woman who was actually a prostitute for a while and had several abortions, and now she's given her life to the Lord, and she counsels women with the Wildflowers group. She has retreats, and she's able to do healing and therapy for them, and it's just a wonderful thing.
Fabulous. Yeah, isn't that great?
Okay, yeah.
So it's just, you know, the thing about God is he'll be there, you know, as the wine is saying in their song, whenever we fall.
Mm-hmm.
But the better news is we don't have to fall at all. So we also have those that are teaching abstinence and keeping power. You know, how do you preserve your sexual purity until you marry?
Mm-hmm.
So you're absolutely right. There are those that have had to live the harder life, but then they develop out ministry through that. God uses them to develop out ministry so that they can keep others from having to go through that harder part to learn the same lesson.
Right.
We can tell them the lesson just based on our own personal experiences, which is one of the reasons that I so readily and openly share my story.
I really appreciate that about you, just your openness, your candor, and I think that really touches people when they can see that you're a real person. You have gone through things, and I think that gives you a lot more credibility when you're talking with people. Now, Star, I want to ask you about an interesting phenomenon I noticed, and maybe you can comment on this. I come from an area that's mostly white, and when I went to school, I went to Jamaica, Queens, St. John's University in New York City. It was the most culturally diverse place on earth, and some of the most amazing lovers of God that I saw were black people and Asian people and Latinos, but mostly black. And you know, I'd never been to a political rally before last year. I went to the Values Voter Summit, and I saw people who love God, who love their country. They were passionate, and they were all conservatives and Republicans. And there were very few minorities there. And I'm thinking to myself, I know that there are a lot of black people who love God, you know, and they have a gift of worship. They're passionate. They love their country. But from my understanding, they were not represented at the Values Voter Summit or in the Republican Party in general. So does the Democratic Party have a core group of minority voters who are passionate followers of Jesus? That's the first part of my question. The second part is, why are there not more such people in the Republican Party?
Well, because people perceive and separate their religion and or their Christianity from their political interest. And I think that there are two questions that you're asking. One is, why are blacks not engaged in the Republican Party and then would participate in a Values Voter Summit?
Hmm.
I believe the answer is that many blacks who perhaps are Christian and have a very emotional connection to that Christianity have not adopted then a biblical worldview to then make sure that that worldview guides them into the voting booth. So what happens is even those that love the Lord, they vote and they develop out their political worldview based on that type of Christianity instead of a biblical worldview. So they vote their economic interest. Most people vote their economic interest.
I see.
Only if you adopt a biblical worldview will you cross your economic interest to see the world not about your personal interest, not about your financial interest, but you see the world in a long-term vision and view. Do you then vote against yourself? And the reason I say against yourself is because when you look at black economic interest, they perceive that they're more tied to the Democrat Party because the Democrat Party is the party that expands government and expands union. And blacks work overwhelmingly for government or union-related work. Hmm. When you think about the black middle class, for instance, the federal government is the number one employer of blacks. So when Republicans say they want to reduce the size and scope of government, blacks would not be interested in this in a general sense.
Hmm.
Perhaps as a biblical Christian, some say, you know, even if I end up in the poorhouse, I would rather be there than to, you know, vote for somebody pro-abortion. I'd rather be there than to vote for somebody pro-homosexual marriage. I'd rather be poor than to violate scripture to the degree that the Democrats do, which is to redistribute wealth. Redistribution of wealth, that whole concept that Democrats have built out their party on, is inconsistent with scripture. It's a violation of the 10th commandment. And the 10th commandment is not to covet. I'm going to have something that somebody else doesn't have, so you go hire politicians to take it from them. That's redistribution of wealth. That's a Democrat platform issue, and that's how they have built out their party. So if
wow.
somebody now is a Christian and they say, I really want to adopt a full biblical worldview, they then would not participate in that party. But, you know, one thing is the party keeps a lot of information away from them. So that now brings to the second part of your question, which is there within the Democrat Party God-fearing, Bible-believing African-American people?
Right.
And I would say absolutely there are. They love God. They go to church on Sunday morning, they worship
yeah.
Him, and they do everything they can.
I've seen that.
To dot the I's and cross the T's, they acknowledge that he is of his existence, but then they go and support a party who built out a platform that's contrary to God's interest.
Hmm.
And then they ignore information when it's brought to them to say, your voting is inconsistent with what you say you believe on Sunday morning. And they just don't want to hear that because then they have to make a decision that most people don't want to make.
Right.
They're going to have to decide, does it profit if I gain the whole world and lose my soul?
Hmm.
What is it that if what is going to happen to me if I begin to vote against my economic interest? What is going to happen to my family? And these are very hard questions for people to have to answer.
Right.
Because it pulls a real faith out of us that most don't have to be able to say, I'm walking anyway, and it doesn't matter if I end up on the street corner as a result of believing this way. That's a real hard thing to ask people to do, especially when they have children.
Sure it is. I mean, once you learn the truth, you know, you can't unlearn it. It forces you to make decisions, you know. Otherwise, you just kind of have to live in compromise, and that's not comfortable.
Right. So you convince yourself that it's not so.
Right, right.
So you separate your realities. You separate your Christian life from your political life or your work life or your community
yeah.
life.
It's like in the movie The Matrix. You got to take the red pill or the blue pill, you know, the truth.
No, I didn't see that, but it probably could come down to that. And I think, actually, I didn't see it, but I do know that we're at, as a society, a crossroads similar to in the 1850s. We can't continue like this.
Right.
So God is going to start making people make hard choices,
mm-hmm.
And so that it will be no more gray. We don't have a purple pill. We have a red or a blue. We have a right or a wrong. Some of my dear friends who are very liberal in their worldview, even though they're wonderful Christian ladies, if you can believe the two are not oxymoron.
Mm-hmm.
But after the election, and they were able to do their part to vote in history and their first black president, they came to my home, two of them, and asked me, so what do you think is going to happen next? And I told them, I think that you individually and everyone in our community is going to get the Apostle Peter moment. The Apostle Peter moment is the moment that he had a choice to make, whether he was going to deny Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't have it both ways. You can't have the purple pill. You have a red pill or a blue pill. So what you have now is one of the most premier and outspoken pro-death, pro-choice, pro-abortion, pro-killing God's reward, whatever you want to call it, in that you've just elected to the White House. You have one of the most cunning and devious now world leader who has a hostility toward the biblical interest to protect Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You have elected somebody that pretends that he doesn't understand what's at stake when you start promoting homosexuality and sodomy to the extent that they do, to where now we're seeing the result of, you know, military. We're seeing the result in marriage and redefining such. It's going to start costing you, because as you may know or may not know, now in the third year of this man's presidency, the culture has shifted to the point that California just installed gay history, and, you know,
wow,
short of a court order to make sure that this does not occur, that she will have her Apostle Peter moment. She's going to now have to decide, am I going to instruct all of my history teachers to begin to incorporate this into their curriculum, or am I going to quit?
Wow. Well, we have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more of Star Parker on Divine Intervention. I'm your host, Daniel Fazina. Stay with us. Hey, this is Daniel Fazina. Thanks for listening to my show, Divine Intervention. If you enjoy the testimonies featured on my talk show, I've also written a book series containing more amazing stories of God's divine interventions and miracles. More information about Divine Intervention, Amazing True Stories of God's Miracles Today, Volumes 1 and 2, can be found at DivineInterventionRadio.com. That's www.DivineInterventionRadio.com. Or by calling 866-381-BOOK. That's 866-381-2665. Welcome back to Divine Intervention Radio. I'm your host, Daniel Fazina, and this is the interview show that features intriguing people who've experienced the hand of God in amazing ways. Today, our special guest is Star Parker, and she is the founder of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. She's a political activist, an author, a commentator, and a follower of Jesus. Star's websites are starparker.com and urbancure.org. Well, Star, welcome back. We've been having a very interesting conversation about Christianity and politics. You know, when you and I met at the Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C., I had posted something online that said, the Values Voter Summit is kind of like the conservative Christian branch of the Republican Party. And a friend of mine wrote to me, who's a liberal, and I think he's actually an atheist too, and he said, I didn't realize there was a Christian conservative branch, in quotes, of the Republican Party. I'm wondering, does the Democratic Party have a Christian segment to it, like a values voters equivalent, maybe? And if not, do you think they should have one?
I don't even know that I would define the value voters that way. I think what has happened is that special interests in Washington have developed because government has expanded itself in places that it doesn't belong.
Okay.
So when you think about organizations like Family Research Council, that's who umbrellas the Value Voter Summit. They have a couple of summits every
right.
year. The Family Research Council, wonderful, wonderful folks. They grew because government was getting itself engaged in places that it didn't belong. They
mm-hmm.
found government in education, and education should be local. They found government trying to undermine Christian values and principles in laws, in different areas, variety of areas. I don't work for them, so I can't tell you 100 areas. But they began to form teams of people that were coming together to vote their values. And their interests are perhaps more Republican than not, simply because the Republican Party is the party with the platform for freedom, for personal responsibility, for prosperity, for free markets, for strong national allegiance. So I think it's the other way around. It's more like here is a constituency that is in the Republican Party that has become the conscience of the party to make them do what they say they're going to do, or to make them be who they say they are to be, which is the Party of Freedom and Opportunity. Now, the question you're asking is, do Democrats have the same thing? Well, yeah, the Democrats have the same thing. They have a lot of special interests, but you don't find that they have special interests that are what you could consider Christianity to the degree that that the value voters are. I think that the opposing organization, I suppose, to value voters, those that pretend that they are looking out for the interest of the body of Christ, would be someone like Barry Lynn's group called the Americans for the Separation of Church and State. Well, what you find about this group is it is the antithesis of the Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's such a aggressive enemy to the Bible that they use the religion and they hide behind church to build out a worldview very, very secular, to push ideas into society that are inconsistent with what the Scripture would want. Are there other groups? Perhaps. But the left surely dominates the Democrat side of the equation. And I suppose that their groups don't have to, or FRC or what Focus on the Family is doing, or organizations like mine and many, many other nonprofits that are trying to push against darkness in our society. The left doesn't have to do that, because one thing that they've very cleverly done over time through law is they begin to own the inner cities. They begin to pay off pastors and preachers who then bring them entire constituencies. You look at this last election, for instance. 25% of Democrats lost their congressional seat because the American people said enough of this. The Tea Party said, we can't go on like this. We are not going to continue to have a nation divided between makers and takers. We're not going to be half free, half slave. We're not going to be inconsistent with the founding. Then, 25% of the Democrats lost their congressional seats as a result. Not one Black caucus member lost their seat. As a result, they all still own these inner cities and keep their lives, the lives of the people that live there, deplorable. Their families are still collapsing. Their communities sit in ruin. Their unemployment rate is 3 times the national average, and they're not held accountable. They're not held accountable because they got the preachers in their pocket. So they don't really need a value voter summit every year. In fact, I would hope that they don't do that, because what they use instead are the NAACP and all the other traditional civil rights groups to push their agenda. They disguise it as being healthy for Christians, and that they may even do prayer when the ideas that they support, they're in the antithesis of Christianity.
Wow. Along those lines, Star, you've actually debated some pretty well-known people, such as Jesse Jackson, on a number of key issues, and he is known as a civil rights leader. What was your experience in debating him, and what were the issues that you talked about?
And a reverend, keep in mind.
Yes.
And Al Sharpton and all the rest of it. Yes, I've debated.
I use the term reverend loosely when I talk about those guys.
Exactly. You're making the point that I attempted to in the last segment that, you know, they don't need a value voter summit. They hide behind symbols. And the sizzle of those saying and the ideas that they're promoting are exactly opposite of what God would hold as truth. What it's like is any debatable situation when you're trying to engage them in reality or engage them in reason or thought. Don't do it. Just speak to the audience. My pastor told me years ago when I started out and I would engage with them and end up in screaming matches and with death threats, he said, you're not talking to them. Stop yelling at me sitting on my couch, because that's what it amounts to. He said, you speak to the people that are watching at that moment. Those are the hearts and minds that you're wanting to engage on, because they will recognize truth. The same way that when you asked me about my born again, I recognize truth. How? I don't know. This is the miracle of the gospel.
Right.
It's probably why he told us to preach the gospel to the poor, because there's a great miracle in it. We can't explain it, but when people hear the truth, all of a sudden they sit up straight and something bursts in them. So that's where he was trying to take me, is you don't debate these folks. You talk to the people that are available to you. And so I made a decision. This is 15, 20 years ago now. I get one shot. I don't even attempt to be invited back to a show.
Mm.
That way I'm going to get in there, I'm going to tell my story, why I believe what I believe. It's one of the reasons I've only done that show, The View. Once in between the vileness of Joy Behar and Barbara Walters, I ignored them. I told my story, why I believe what I believe. And people, we began to get pouring in of letters from women that said, wow, I've never even thought about it that way.
Mm.
Because they just happen to have that show on while they're, you know, letting their little kidlets take naps in the afternoon. So that's great. Yeah, Jesse, I don't care who they are that I'm going to debate. I'm not on there to debate them. I'm on there to talk to the people that would listen to them and to give them an alternative discussion.
Mm-hmm. And on that show on The View, was that the one where you talked with Michael Moore?
He was their guest on the show. And then during the break time, Joey did everything she could to see if I could be taken off. But I was one of their guest hosts. This was during the time that Star Jones had left the show, mm-hmm. and they didn't find Whoopi yet, and they're so politically correct that they needed a black. So they were just going through any black and every black that they could find, you know, to just fill that seat with a black until they could find a permanent black. It's one of the problems with, you know, that type of mentality that just,
wow.
you know, tries to draw a picture that's just not true. So I got opportunity to sit in that seat thanks to John Stossel. And we knew Michael Moore was going to be on, and I wanted to ask him one question about his health care ideas, and that was why he would go to Canada and Cuba to see socialized medicine when he can go to Compton or Camden. You want to see what it looks like when government controls health care? Go into these hard-hit communities and see if you can find a specialist, any doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Can you even find a hospital without long waiting lines? Look at the horrors of what happens in some of these institutions that we call hospitals that are controlled by government. Look at Medicaid. You just peep it back a little bit, and you'll just cover it up real quick because it is ugly.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to ask him that one question, yeah, I had to go through quite a bit. God owes me goody points. I said, that's my I get to heaven. That's the one I'll ask about now.
That is amazing. Well, I can't wait to see the highlight films from heaven, what was going on when you were on there. And it's amazing that he opened up that door for you and gave you such a huge platform. I mean, that's a huge show.
They say 7 million women.
That's great, and you were able to speak truth to them.
7 million women sitting there trying to just hear something, and so I gave them something to think about.
That's wonderful. I'm proud of you for doing that, and I'm thankful. I mean, that's you know, it's great stuff. Now, I have to ask you another question that kind of maybe philosophical, but I had a liberal friend ask me or tell me one time that when Jesus said you should sell your belongings and give all to the poor, that was an indication that he was a socialist. And I kind of disagree with that. I don't think he would be a socialist because in my mind, socialism is stealing from one and giving to another. If you give it of yourself, that's not socialism. That's being altruistic and benefiting someone else at your own choice. Can you comment on that? Because that argument just really kind of gets under my skin where people say Jesus was a socialist because he taught that you should give to the poor.
So Jesus taught that individuals should give to the poor.
Right.
He did not teach that you go to Caesar and have Caesar confiscate from your neighbor to give to the poor. Now, this is an individual relationship that people to have with poor people. And one of the reasons that he separated it from the state is because he included in helping the poor the preaching of the gospel, that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. See, God wants the gospel preached to the poor for a very specific reason. It's the miracle in the gospel being preached to the poor. When people really understand that God is not mad at them, that he loves them enough to have sent his own son to die for them, that he wants to restore them to himself, then they begin to appreciate their existence, and then they start to fulfill their destiny. So it's really a critical component, and government has no relationship in this. There's no fellowship between light and dark. And so, no, God, Jesus was not a socialist. He was instructing on how we work with our neighbor and love our neighbor and come together as a community of individual believers to tithe and offer to our church, so that the poor will not have need. You know, it wasn't just in the discussion when he went into the temple and just so happened to be the reading that day from Isaiah that said that we are to preach the gospel to the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the consistency of when John the Baptist was in jail, his cousin was in jail, and he sent his disciples, because he had heard about Jesus, he sent his disciples to say, are you the one or do we look for another? And if you recall what Jesus told the disciples to go back and tell John. He told him, go tell him this. The blind are seeing. The lame are walking. The dead are being raised. The lepers are being healed. And the gospel is being preached to the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't seem to fit there. Because when blind people start looking, that is a great miracle. When dead people start raising, that is an unbelievable miracle.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we can believe it is by faith, unless we know someone that actually was dead and now is alive.
I know a couple. I've interviewed a few.
Yeah. So you know it's a miracle.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen to everybody.
No.
There's some people that pray endlessly to let me die, and they die anyway. And,
right.
and so it's a miracle when dead raised. It's a miracle when lepers are cleansed. It is a miracle when the deaf begin to talk. These are all, so there must be a great miracle in the gospel being preached to the poor since it was included in that little summary. So
right.
that John the Baptist would understand that, yes, I'm the one. You need not look for another.
Mm-hmm.
So to lose that component, that personal element, because we allow government to do charity, which is what we call socialism, is not consistent with Jesus Christ. He was not a socialist. And in fact, if he scriptures that God first gave on the to Moses on the Mount of Zion, he told him, here are 10 commandments, and the 10th commandment is not to covet.
Mm-hmm.
And socialism is rooted in covetousness. I'm going to have something that somebody else doesn't have, so we hire politicians to take it from them.
Right, that's also violating don't steal either, right?
Oh, yeah, steal. Yes, yeah, let's go to that commandment. That's right, because you're not getting letters
mm-hmm.
from the IRS that say, would you like to benevolently give to these poverty programs that we've designed out so that people like Star Parker can go continue to live recklessly and lawlessly until finally she falls on her head. No, they
wow.
didn't send you that letter. They sent you a letter that would force you to give up for this welfare state. But they sent out so much that now we redistribute $700 billion a year just for poverty programs.
Hmm.
$700 billion a year. And most people can't even name one of the programs. And if they name one, they can't name one that's working. We're a long way from you go sell what you have and give it to the poor.
Right.
We're a long way from you feed them. When Jesus saw homelessness and hunger, 5,000 at one point, 4,000 another, and his disciples said, what do we do? He did not say, go send them to Caesar. Send them to the Romans so that they could get in line for food stamp. No, he said, you feed them.
Mm.
And they said, we don't have anything. Well, what are we going to get for the food? And he brought them a fish into the loaf, and we saw yet another miracle.
Right.
The problem with government doing this work is we don't see miracles in it. What we see is more despair. What we see now is out-of-wedlock birth rates that are unrecoverable. What we see is the HIV virus ravishing entire communities. What we see are people that are just so bankrupt morally that now they're drug addicted, so we've created new problems. What we see is abortion rates at 50 million.
Mm.
That's what we see when government gets involved in doing what God has asked us to do.
Wow. And, you know, and if the government is stepping in, that's going to take responsibility away from the church, or perceived responsibility, and they say, well, we don't have to do it because the government's going to take care of them.
Yes, allowing the complicity of the church to allow this to occur. Folks don't want to give to God through their tithes, so the cruel taskmaster comes in and demands it in taxes so that the pastor can go play on his jet, and then one of the biggest pastors in the country is on one of these national television shows, and when they're asked about just simple questions, like homosexuality, they start to edging and moving and can't decide what they want to say and start fumbling over their words when God is extremely clear on that point.
Hmm.
The church is complicit.
And
we want to have it that way. Remember what Jeremiah said, you know, when you think about what the reality of, you know, you got the preachers lying, the priests are not doing what they're supposed to do, and the people love it this way.
Hmm. Well, I remember reading about you know, when the people of Israel were begging for a king, and the prophet's like, no, you really don't want a king, because he's going to tax you, he's going to, you know, send your men to war, and they're like, no, everyone else has a king, we want a king.
Yeah.
So he gave him a king, and, you know, that's what ended up happening. Men were sent to war, and they were taxed, and, you know, you mentioned the IRS before, and how they'll threaten you or take your money or whatever. You know, we didn't even have an IRS or an income tax or a Federal Reserve until 1913. Our country survived for over 100 years without it. I'm sure if we wanted to, we could survive just fine without it nowadays. I'm not even sure why people think it's necessary. I don't think it is.
Well, see, this is why I think people should not be so dismissive of what Herman Cain has put on the table regarding his 999 plan, especially when it comes to the national sales tax. You'll hear even conservatives saying, well, you know, it's just going to add another tax. We're not sure that we want to do that. I mean, all you're doing is giving Washington more. Wait. Let's step back one moment and say, what if the national sales tax, because you've also brought your balance, you've balanced your budget and you've brought everything in place and you stopped this aggressive spend, what if the national sales tax actually replaces the federal income tax? That's the one that's inconsistent with the founding of the country. The income tax is the one that's inconsistent. people assume that we have to live with this reality forever. No, it's kind of like driving a stick shift car. I remember the first car I learned how to drive on had a stick shift, and I could still remember hearing that if you don't want to start bouncing all over the place and spill your coffee, you have to very delicately, at the same time you press on the gas, you lift off the clutch. So there comes a real balance to make it really smooth. And I think that there might be elements of that in that 999. We can keep manipulating around the edges of the federal income tax, or we can start developing out an idea that we can replace that income tax, because I agree with you that we were a nation without it. So obviously the framers of the country didn't see it necessary, or they would have installed one at that time to become government.
From my understanding, if you actually follow the Constitution, they set it up where there were two types of taxes, one direct and one indirect, and they made provisions for the raising of both. They left raising the money to taxing imports, duties, and excises. In other words, they wanted to tax foreigners at home and leave the citizen free, and they would tax U.S. citizens who were living and working abroad. So if you really read the Constitution and what the framers wrote, they had provisions for raising money. For direct taxes, they had to make them apportioned. So if the federal government needed to raise money, they would come up with a sum total, and then they would assess each state the appropriate percentage based on their population. So the larger states would get a larger percentage of the bill, and the smaller states would get a smaller amount. So it would be fair based on the size of the population of each state, and it would be finite. There would be a sum total, and once that was met, the tax would end. But we've kind of abandoned those principles since 1913, which it's only 100 years old. For all of our history prior to that, we didn't have a federal income tax. People could keep the fruit of their labor, and I think the founders, they understood that. And I think we would do well to go back.
And this could be why we're having these discussions now, because it is coming on that 100-year mark.
Yeah. And you know what else, Star? Just boggles my mind. If the government and the Federal Reserve can print money, I mean, they just print it out of nothing, print it into existence, and they issue it, why do they need to take it from us? You ever think about that?
No.
Well, it's because
control.
Yeah, and it's
control of our lives to make sure that we send the money to them.
Right.
Well, actually, not even us, our employer. And then they wonder why our employer has a lobbyist in Washington to try to figure out what they did with that money that they forced out of his coffers, and now they control in Washington D.C. to do it to support his his competitor.
Yeah.
So it's a vicious cycle, and that's why I think the discussions that are occurring today are necessary.
Yeah,
we can't keep going like this as
no.
a society. We, as I said, have said many, many times in the last few years now, right, even before the Tea Party, and now I'm glad to hear from them during the time that Washington was way off track, that we're at that critical cross point like in the 1850s. We've got to make a decision.
Right.
We've got to make a decision who we're going to be. That's what Abraham Lincoln, he reached into the scriptures, and he said, a house divided against itself can't stand.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I don't think the union's going to dissolve, but we can no longer be half free and half slave. We have to make a decision.
Right.
So that's the great battle before us right now as a nation. Who are we going to be? Are we going to be free, God-fearing men that are responsible with the choices that we make? Or are we going to be secular and socialist and manipulate our neighbors to get what we want for a temporary gain?
Mm.
We have to make that choice.
Right. Well, this is certainly a lot of good food for thought. And since we just mentioned the Federal Reserve and the income tax, I got to give out a couple of resources to recommend to my listeners. If you want to really understand this issue of what the Federal Reserve is and its history and why we have an income tax, you have to check out The Creature from Jekyll Island. This book is amazing. It's by G. Edward Griffin. And again, it's called The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. You can find it in the economics section of your bookstore. The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve by G. Edward Griffin is a must-read for every American who's concerned about these things. And also a great documentary on this subject is Aaron Russo's America from Freedom to Fascism, an amazing documentary that goes into these issues as well, very eye-opening and sobering. Again, that's America from Freedom to Fascism by Aaron Russo. I'm Daniel Fazina. You're listening to Divine Intervention Radio, and our special guest today is Star Parker. She is the founder and president of CURE, the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. She is a prolific author and a writer and a political activist and a follower of Jesus. Star, we didn't really get to talk about CURE, but can you tell us how you got into CURE, how you founded it, and why?
Well, I founded it after most of the discussions on welfare reform in the mid-90s because I was a consultant there, and we as a nation were saying we can't keep doing this. We can't keep paying people to be irresponsible and breaking down entire families, communities. And so I wanted to then be on the edge of thought on what we do next. Where do we go from here? So I founded CURE as a think tank, and so we assess market-based solutions to fight poverty. We promote those ideas, whether they're in the area of personal responsibility and or labor and or education, you know, all of the elements to break the cycle of poverty. We try to weigh in on ideas as they're flowing through Washington to try to get into public policy initiatives that will help people recover their lives, that will help free them so that they then can be responsible and prosperous citizens.
Awesome. Star, your books have very provocative titles. I love it. One is called Pimps, Whores, and Welfare Brats. The other is called White Ghetto. And your newest one is called Uncle Sam's Plantation. Can you tell us briefly about what they're about?
Well, autobiography, Pimps, Whores, and Welfare Brats, of course, is my journey. But the one that I get a lot of attention behind and I think is very, very relevant, I subtitled that book, Uncle Sam's Plantation, how, you know, we are destroying the poor, how big government enslaves the poor, and what we could do about it. Mm. And what I found is after welfare reform, we started seeing momentum that people were recovering their lives. But then in this last election, we lost that momentum. We're going the wrong way. Not only are we not moving people from slavery to freedom in our impoverished communities, we're moving the free part of America into slavery in our middle-class communities. Big government is slavery, in my estimation and opinion. So we re-released the book to talk about that scenario of what we see in our inner cities. We will end up in the scenario of what the Europeans see in their inner cities. You know, people say, we don't want to go away from Europe. And then when people hear that, they think about designer shoes and handbags and say, well, it can't be that bad.
Mm.
You don't know how their poor live because their media is controlled by one entity, and they don't show you how absolutely inhumane, should I call it, or animalist that some of these communities in Europe are, where government has just been extremely destructive.
Right. Once again, we are speaking with Star Parker. She is the founder and president of CURE, the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. And Star, we just got a couple minutes left. Real quick, if there's someone listening to this interview right now who maybe they were living lawlessly, maybe they just don't know if there's a God, they don't know the Lord, what would you like to say to them?
Since we only have a moment, perhaps I should just let them know that the psalmist was very correct in 23 when he said that the Lord is his shepherd. He has everything he needs, everything you need. It's really simple. You just say, okay, Lord, okay. And that's really it. He begins then to speak to you in a small voice. You get yourself in a church that believes the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, that God was in Christ, reconciling the world to himself, not counting our sin against you. You begin to grow and develop in your biblical worldview, and you begin to live in peace and true freedom.
Mm. Amen. Well, Star Parker, thank you so much for taking the time out to share your story and your views and your insights on divine intervention. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
You are welcome. Well, friends, that concludes our show for this week. I hope this episode has encouraged you to know that God is real and he is still changing the world one heart at a time. I'm Daniel Fazina. Once again, if you'd like to get in touch with Star, you can check out her website, urbancure.org. And our guest has been Star Parker, the founder and president of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can hit me up at divineintervention@mail.com, divineintervention@mail.com. And of course, all of our shows are archived. Check us out online, divineinterventionradio.com. God willing, we'll see you again next week for another exciting episode of Divine Intervention. Take care and God bless.